This is a wonderful passage. It's a very significant moment in the history of the world. And so often we look at it and we consider these disciples and we say, how careless they are. How could they fall asleep at such a time as this? Such a privilege afforded to them to be with Christ at such an intimate moment in time. Privilege and yet carelessness. And we scoff at them sometimes without even considering our own carelessness with the privileges that we've been given. I was leaving Safeways about a week and a half ago with my shopping. It was an enormous trolley. I don't know why I'd shopped so much. It wasn't Christmas or a bank holiday or anything. But it's a great big trolley, and I had my son with me, and we were heading towards the doors of Safeways. I heard my name really loud. I thought, gosh, is God speaking to me? No, it wasn't. It was the tannoy system in Safeways. Why me? Why do they want me? Have I left my wallet at the till? No. Have I walked away with something that isn't mine? No. Maybe I'd left the handbrake on and the car had rolled through the car park, causing destruction and mayhem. No, I'd left my other son in the creche. The privilege of parenthood and a moment of carelessness. The privilege of being a disciple. How many moments of carelessness do we count up in our lives? Jesus has gone with his disciples to the Mount of Olives. John tells us this was a familiar place. The disciples and Jesus would often meet there. Judas knew exactly that was the place they would be if the upper room was empty. If you read on verse 47, Judas arrived. He knew that they would be on the Mount of Olives. They'd gone to a particular part of the mountain, the place called Gethsemane. It means oil press, where the olives were squeezed and oil was made. Peter, James, and John, the three who go with Jesus into the heart of that place, would remember it for many years. They wouldn't remember it for the olives being put under pressure to create oil. They would remember the pressure they themselves had been put under that night. And I believe they would have remembered it with an awkward silence at their weakness, at the fact that they fell asleep when Jesus asked them to watch and pray. The next time they would visit this mountain would be at the point of the ascension, as Jesus Christ was taken back up into heaven to his Father. This visit, however, I believe they learnt some important and salutary lessons about prayer. Let's then look at the passage. There are five times, as I say, that the word pray is mentioned. We're going to look at each of those and one other spot, and we're going to draw out six lessons for prayer. We begin at the beginning of the passage. Jesus went with his disciples to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to them, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." Matthew has traced for us the last evening of Jesus before his crucifixion. He tells us the story of the Last Supper. In the midst of that supper table is a man who is facing certain death. Like many who are dying and are facing death, Jesus is far more aware of what is going on than all of those around him. In many ways, he faces it alone. If you've ever sat with somebody or been with somebody as they're facing death, you'll know that you can come alongside them, but you can't quite enter into the place that they are at. There is a certain stillness, a certain silence, a certain inner sanctum that we cannot penetrate. Jesus knew that he faced death, and his disciples accompanied him during the supper. At the end of the supper, we're told here, when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. That hymn would have been one of the Hallel Psalms. Psalms 113 to 118. Psalms that praise God for his goodness and speak of his deliverance. Oh, the poignancy of those words as Jesus sung them that night. Can you just imagine it? I don't think we can. Jesus has now come to Gethsemane, and it's his time to be with his God. Jesus, you see, is not like the many Christian martyrs who have gone gladly to the grave to meet their Maker. He is not like the Christians that you and I may have been honoured to sit with as they face death, assured of God's peace and his presence. Because quite simply, Jesus is not a Christian. He dies knowing that it is the Father's will that he should face death utterly alone. No wonder we read in the next verse that he is sorrowful and troubled. Job's friend, Bildad, he describes death as the king of terrors. Death is the very negation of life itself. Christ is the giver of life. He's present there at the creation of the world, and now he faces death apart from God. No wonder in the next chapter we read his words, these words, my God, why have you forsaken me? In the garden, he contemplates that separateness, that forsakenness. For only he can drink the cup of God's wrath. Only he can do that for you and for me. And only he can do it alone. No wonder he prays. No wonder lesson one is that Jesus needs to pray. His humanity is on display to us all. Hebrews chapter 5 gives us a great commentary on this. During the days of Jesus' life on earth, he offered up prayers and petitions with loud cries and tears to the one who could save him from death, and he was heard because of his reverent submission. Lesson 2. Jesus desired others to pray with him. Read verse 38, would you? Then he said, verse 37 and 38. He took Peter and the two sons of Zebedee along with him, and he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, my soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me. He's held these emotions in, this fear, all the way through the supper, all the way through the singing of the halal, all through the walk to the Mount of Olives. And now, with just his three closest friends, he lets go of the emotion within him. He pours out his heart and he cries to God in fear. I went to the National Gallery on Tuesday to the Seeing Salvation art exhibition, which I'd thoroughly recommend. In room 4 of the art exhibition, the room which is called Passion and Compassion, there is my favourite item in the exhibition. It's a statue, it's a sculpture. It's a sculpture of Christ sitting on a stone alone. The sculpture was inspired by Lamentations 1 and verse 12. Do you know it? It goes like this. Is it nothing to you, all you who pass by? Look around and see. Is any suffering like my suffering that was inflicted on me, that the Lord brought on me in the day of his fierce anger? Jesus Christ alone. He knows that these disciples, Peter, James, and John, cannot fully support him. He knows of their weakness. He knows that they will fail them. He's told them they will fail them, that they will fail him. And like him, we cannot expect others to fully enter into the full extent of our suffering. Perhaps that's why Jesus says, keep watch with me. To ask them to pray would be too much, but to ask them to keep watch with him, to be alert with him, to be with him. Maybe that's as much as he can ask. Ephesians 6 and 18, be alert and keep always praying for others. He knows they cannot enter into the fullest of his agonies, but he knows he wants them there, and he wants to share with them this moment. We can gain incredible support from praying with others. We can gain incredible support from sharing our burdens with Christian friends. They're called in the Christian tradition a soul friend or a spiritual friend. Do you have one? Jesus here picks three. Have you three? Have each of us three friends who we can go to and unburden our hearts and share with in prayer? Jesus needed them there with him. He desired them to be with him there. He teaches in Matthew 6 that we should go away quietly and shut the door and pray. In Matthew 14, he sends the disciples away and prays alone. But here is a time when he wants them with him. He desires those others to be with him in prayer. It's not a sign of helplessness. It's a fusing together of vulnerability and maturity. Vulnerability as we face the struggles of this world, maturity as we recognize the need to face them with others. Do you do that? Do you have others who you can share with in prayer? Lesson 3, verse 39. The prayer of prostration. Going a little further, he fell with his face to the ground and prayed, "My Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me, yet not as I will, but as you will." Jesus prostrates himself on the floor before his Father. Moses prostrates himself before God as he pleads for Israel's deliverance. In Revelation chapter 4, the 24 elders fall down before the throne of God. This very physical way of prostration might not be something we do today in our churches or even in our homes, but it's a giving of the whole of oneself in prayer. And that we should do. That we should do. This prostration is a very Jewish way of prayer. It's a very physical position for prayer. And I believe it challenges each one of us as we sit comfortably in our armchairs and then have the audacity to plead with Almighty God. There are two things that happen when he prostrates himself here. Firstly, petition. Petition. "My Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me, yet not as I will, but as you will. Let this cup of God's wrath pass me by." Mark tells us that at this point Jesus also said, "For you, Father, all things are possible." It was possible. God could take away this agony and this suffering, but he doesn't. And Jesus, I believe, in that moment struggles as we do with unanswered prayer. We're told also in Luke that God sends an angel to comfort him, to minister to him. So his prayer is heard, but not quite answered in the way that he first announces, "Take this cup from me." But there are two desires going on here within Jesus himself. There is the desire that the suffering and the agony and the terror would be removed. But there is a deeper desire still, a desire to do God's will. "Yet not as I will," he pleads, "but as you will." That deeper prayer that emerges as Christ prays to be delivered from this awful moment. I think the second thing that goes on at this point of the prayer of prostration is a time of silence, a time of just being with God. We're told here, you see, that he prays 22 words, "My Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me, yet not as I will, but as you will." And then he returns and asks them why they have not stayed awake for even 1 hour. Now, I can't say 22 words slowly enough to fill a whole hour. In fact, you'd be very bored if you did, and you would learn about sleeping, I imagine. It's not told what happens in that hour. Maybe the Spirit groaned within Jesus, as we read in Romans, words that he couldn't utter. Maybe it was simply a time of being with God, and maybe it was a time of quiet. I think we've sometimes forgotten to be quiet. Our world is a noisy place. Our homes are very often rushed and busy and noisy. The advent of the mobile phone means that nothing is ever going to be left quiet again. What about our prayer lives? Do they picture the world? Are they an image of the world, or are they an image of the mystery of God? Are our prayer lives little shopping lists? Or are there times when we simply sit and contemplate the nature of God and dwell in his presence? In the RSV, Psalm 62 verse 1 begins with these words, "For God alone my soul waits in silence." C.S. Lewis claims that prayer without words is the best. The early church fathers often found that it was in silence that God indwelt them and grew their faith. And Isaiah 55 proclaims, God says, listen to me. Do you listen to God? Do you immerse yourself in the very heart and the depths of God? Or is your prayer life too busy with words to really focus on the being of God? Lesson 4. We need to pray. This is probably the most obvious lesson in the passage, actually, and no marks for spotting it. Verse 40 and 41, he returns to his disciples and found them sleeping. Could you men not keep watch with me for 1 hour? He asked Peter. Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the body is weak. Now, what brought these four men to this amazing moment in the history of the world? Jesus is there facing his death. Peter, just earlier in the chapter, verses 31 to 35, has discussed with Jesus his determination to stand with him. Jesus says, this very night you will fall away from me. Peter says, I will not fall away from you. Jesus says, actually, you're going to deny me. Peter says, no, not me. I will never disown you, but I will fall asleep when you ask me to stay awake. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. What about James and John? Well, it's a few chapters earlier we see them, Matthew chapter 20, when their mother brings them to Jesus and asks for the best seats for them. And Jesus says to them, can you drink the cup? Can you drink the cup that I'm actually going to pray will be taken away from me because it's so painful? Of course we can, they say. Of course we can stay and we can drink the cup. But we can't stay awake for you 1 hour. The privilege of the Christian life, the moments of carelessness. Peter, James and John, they're determined. They're determined to stand by Christ. They're committed. They're resolute. But they cannot do it. Throughout the church's history, we are reminded time and time again that times of the greatest spiritual significance, the carnal desires grab us, the flesh is weakest. How temptation creeps upon us all as the unseen enemy. Those words that Steve read at the beginning of the service before our confession are actually here in my sermon notes. I'm not pinching them, honest. Paul says these words, for what I do is not the good I want to do. No, the evil I do not want to do, this I keep on doing. We need to pray. Oh, we need to pray. Mark tells us that in the face of this moment, the disciples do not know what to say. Guilt is written across their faces when Jesus returns to them. But it needn't be, because the Son of Man doesn't condemn them. He simply urges them to fight their inner weakness with the only weapon that can beat it, the power of prayer. And each of us in this room today need to go away from here this morning and pray like we have never prayed before. The world is full of temptation. The church is full of temptation. Our very beings are full of temptation. Lesson 5, the prayer of relinquishment. Verse 42, we move on to the next time we find that word prayed. Jesus went away a second time and prayed, my Father, if it is not possible for this cup to be taken away, do you notice the change there? He now says, if it is not possible for this cup to be taken away unless I drink it, may your will be done. There's a movement. That deeper desire to see God's will is rising. The desire to have the cup taken away is being submerged in his desire to see God's will carried out. It's a bit like the dentist, isn't it? I need to go to the dentist at the moment. I want to have one of those little sort of health checkups and a little scrape and a polish, and I get sometimes a free toothbrush at my dentist, and it's quite a nice trip. But I run the risk in going to the dentist that she will find that I need some root treatment or a filling, and then I would have to go through excruciating pain and then pay for it. I never understand the dentist. I don't know why we invented them. But we relinquish ourselves once we sit in the dentist's chair. We put ourselves at their mercy. This is the prayer of relinquishment. Jesus' desire to see God's will is rising. His desire to have the cup taken away is submerging. And he is relinquishing himself to God. That is a very important process for each of us to go through in our prayer lives. The prayer of relinquishment. Lesson 6, I've called it the prayer of conversion. If you look down now to verse 43 and 44, another time Jesus comes back. He again finds them asleep because their eyes were heavy. So he left them and went away once more and prayed the third time, saying the same thing. Now, why do you think he says the same thing? Why does Jesus need to pray again exactly the same words as that prayer of relinquishment? Surely he's given himself to God. Oh, if it were that easy. Oh, if giving ourselves to God and his will was that easy. I don't know how many of you have prayed to see God's purpose in your life or to see him show you a direction to go. And it begins to be made manifest before you and you begin to see the direction God wants you to take. You haven't quite yet got the courage and the strength to step into it. And you pray again and again. We might call it the prayer of repetition. Hebrews 5 again is very helpful here. 5 and verse 8, because of his reverent submission, although he was a son, he learned obedience from what he suffered. That's what happens at the prayer of conversion. Obedience. We mistake obedience sometimes in the Christian church, thinking it's a set of boxes to be ticked. Do I do this and that? Do I live this way and that? That's not obedience. Obedience is a lifestyle. It's a whole life orientated towards the throne of God. In praying yet again, Jesus is converted. His whole being is reorientated, and he has put aside that sorrow and that trouble. His desires have been submerged beneath his desire to see God's will, and he is now ready. Look how ready he is, because he returns in verse 45 to the disciples and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Look, the hour is near, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us go." Through this prayers, Jesus has moved from the point of sorrow and trouble. Sorrow, if you look, to the point of dying. He could have died simply from the sorrow that was in his heart. He has given himself to God, and now strengthened by the Spirit, he is prepared and ready to go the way of the cross. Even before the cross, Christ has won a battle here in Gethsemane. The battle between the flesh and the spirit. And he has won it through prayer alone. That's what each of us need to take with us from this morning. Let me remind you those six lessons of prayer. Firstly, Christ needed to pray. Secondly, Christ desired others to be with him in prayer. Thirdly, the prayer of prostration, of petition and of silence. Fourthly, we need to pray. To withstand temptation, we need to pray. Fifthly, this prayer of relinquishment. Sixthly, this prayer of conversion. And where does it take us? It takes us back into the world of Christian practice. Verse 46, the last verse in our passage. Rise, let us go. The words of Jesus have moved from watch and pray to rise, let us go. Prayer leads to practice. It is not in itself an end alone. Jesus begged not to die. He knows our griefs, he hears our prayers, and he feels for us when we feel they go unanswered, for he has been there too. Our prayers are always heard, but not always answered the way we want. Because we have to learn the prayer of relinquishment. The disciples slept. They didn't pray. And temptation did come upon them. Not to commit adultery. Not to murder. Not to rob. Not to preach heresy. But simply to fall asleep. A careless moment with the privilege they've been given. So again, how is your prayer life? Are you praying? Here on this awful night at the oil press, Jesus teaches us here in Matthew 26 the value, purpose, and vitality of prayer. Let's be still for a moment. When you prayed beneath the trees, when you cried upon your knees, it was for me, O Lord. So teach each one of us to pray and to cry out to you.